Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. It's been a week or two since I've been able to last put something up, but I'm going to break the drought now. I've been working on a couple of textbooks, more on that later. Today I want to talk about an issue I think that perhaps doesn't get enough coverage. Most of the explaining history stuff that I do tends to be slightly more Eurocentric. I'm trying to break that up at the moment. I'm really focused on China, Japan and the Ottoman Empire. Today we're going to talk about China, and China from the Opium Wars onwards. A period from the 1840s through to the first century, the 20th century, first decade of the 20th century, is massively crucial in terms of our understanding of 20th century world history and China's place in it. China is convulsed by the impact of Western imperialism and also of a revolutionary anti-Qing dynasty protests that stem from that. Quite simply, China in the 20th century is the product of the meeting of ancient China and the unstoppable force of Western imperialist expansion and Western technological, economic and military superiority. And the shockwaves of China's crisis in the 19th century ripple out particularly to Japan, and Japan's modernisation is really a response to the problems that China faces. So Chinese insularity is threatened in the first half of the 19th century, particularly by Britain. Britain has a marvellous staging post in India to probe forth into China. The huge population is seen very quickly by British mercantile adventurers as being a wonderful resource to be exploited, and the manner in which they choose to exploit this is with opium. The reason why opium was used as a kind of a sledgehammer to break China open is because it was easy to grow in India and in Egypt. There were large quantities of it, and China was resistant to accepting British manufactured goods. This presented Britain with a problem. Britain was very eager to buy Chinese raw materials, particularly things like silk and tea. Huge quantities of it. And Britain by the 1830s has a balance of trade crisis. China is easily selling her raw materials to Britain, and Britain is unable to sell into China until, of course, opium is tried. Opium had been a staple within certain parts of Chinese peasant life for many centuries, but it had never been mass-produced and mass-exported in an industrial, modern way before the British arrived on the scene. And the results are, as you can imagine, catastrophic. Mass addiction throughout the southern provinces of China is rife. And when the emperor intervenes and legislates to limit the opium trade and to pass punitive laws which would imprison and perhaps even execute Western or Chinese opium agents within China, the British react with the First Opium War. So between 1839 and 1842, China is roundly humiliated by the British and is brought to her knees. Chinese junks cannot match the new firepower of the Royal Navy, and the Chinese Navy is swiftly destroyed, and there is a limited ground invasion. The result of this is the Treaty of Nanking, where the Chinese are forced to give concessions to British traders, and it is one of the first of a series of concessions over the next 50 years, which open up China more and more to foreign trade. Now, the problem that the Chinese very quickly experience is this is not trade on equal terms. The opening up of Chinese markets floods them with mass-produced, cheap British goods, destroying artisan trades and resulting in kind of unemployment in certain sectors which has never really been experienced before. Britain is allowed to open treaty ports in places like Shanghai, and also the Chinese are forced to hand over Hong Kong to the British on an extended lease, but really it is a British colony. The result of all of this as well is that other Western countries, from France to the United States, realise that China is in a particularly vulnerable position, and now they can exert influence and force concessions from the Chinese too. So it begins a kind of an avalanche, really, of concessions to the West. China's sense of herself as being the Middle Kingdom, the centre of the world, the centre of civilization, the most important country in the world and the most powerful country in the world, is absolutely shattered. And the ensuing sense of crisis results in widespread social and cultural and political trauma for the Chinese. And one of the results of this is the Taiping Rebellion that happens in the 1850s. The explosion of anger that comes with the Taiping Rebellion is less directed against Western powers than it is against the Qing Dynasty itself. And it begins with the dreams and the prophecies of a peasant mystic, Hong Zhikan, who has a vision of Jesus Christ appearing to him, asking him to rid China of her demons. Missionary Christianity had spread to China quite successfully by the 1850s, so it's no surprise that a kind of a millenarian, apocalyptic, end-of-days version of Christianity with a distinctly Chinese aspect to it had rooted itself in the peasant psyche. Hong Zhikan led a peasant revolt which exploded into the largest conflict of the 19th century. The Taiping Rebellion would, over 15 years, claim 20 million lives and nearly come close to toppling the Qing Dynasty itself. The Qing Dynasty were Manchu Chinese. They'd come from the north. The majority of the population in China are Han Chinese. So the Qing Dynasty were seen by many Han peasants as being foreigners themselves, in much the way that Hindu and Sikh peasants in India looked upon the Mughal Empire with immense suspicion and dislike. The Manchus were, during the period of the Opium Wars, giving away China in the eyes of ordinary Han Chinese peasants. And there was a connection in their eyes, one group of foreign devils helping out another. At the very least, many Han Chinese looked upon the Qing Dynasty as being too weak, too ineffectual. By the 1860s, the high tide of the Taiping Rebellion had been and gone, and gradually, unfortunately for the Qing Dynasty, using Western techniques and Western expertise and even Western mercenaries, the Qing regained control. But not before really a second Opium War happening. Even though it was crushed, Hong Zhikan would go on to be an inspiration to Sun Yat-sen, who would become the father of modern China, but more importantly, to Mao Zedong in the 20th century, who would look upon the vitality and the power of the Chinese peasants and believe that it was evidence that there was revolutionary strength within the peasantry, and that a peasant revolution, which was really the essence of Maoism, would be how history would be moved forward. From 1856 to 1860, there's a Second Opium War. The British suspect that the Chinese are looking to wriggle out of their obligations under the Treaty of Nanking, and they launch a punitive war against China, and obviously, you, with the help of the French this time, managed to beat China and to impose yet more stringent terms upon her. But this time, the British managed to make it all the way to Beijing and besiege the capital, for causing the emperor to flee, and in a moment of epic vandalism, the British burned down the emperor's summer palace, one of the kind of the great wonders of the Eastern world. It was mooted by Lord Elgin that it might be a good idea to burn down the Forbidden City, the seat of Chinese government for millennia. However, this was seen as perhaps a bit too far, and they settled on destroying the Summer Palace instead. What really happens after Second Opium War is that China isn't occupied in the same way that India is, or colonised in the same way that India is. But a process takes place in China which is very similar to the one which was happening at the same time throughout the Ottoman Empire, in that China is economically, politically, and to an extent institutionally, legally colonised. The Chinese economy is interfered with and intervened in by Western powers to enable a huge extraction of wealth from the country. The Chinese legal system is amended to give the Western merchants, soldiers, traders, adventurers and missionaries in China legal immunity, even when they've committed some quite serious crimes. The Chinese government is powerless to really legislate effectively within her own territories when it comes to dealing with foreigners. And the Chinese people are completely aware of this. They can see that they have become, you know, a quasi-colonised country. And the question in everyone's minds is, what is to be done about this? There are a number of schools of thought within official circles as to whether embracing Western modernisation will eventually strengthen China sufficiently for her to stand up to her enemies. In Japan, the answer after 1868 is almost unequivocally, yes, this is exactly the thing to do. Japan has had no way near the level of intervention in her economy or society that the Chinese have. And Japan's particular characteristics of it being a kind of an insular, hierarchical society with a skilled bureaucratic class and a samurai enable her to eventually very quickly adapt to becoming a militarised, industrialised power. And in 1905, her destruction of the Russian Navy announces to the world that Japan is a significant world player. China doesn't manage to resolve this question quick enough. There are various moves towards modernisation, various moves towards embracing the lessons taught by the West. But there's also a question of what happens to traditional Chinese values, what happens to Confucianism that has operated so skillfully and operated so effectively within China for 3,000 years. China is obviously the bearer of the world's oldest and most successful civilization.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Civilization. So the question of abandoning Confucianism or modifying it for the future is a very fraught one. Now, the book that I would urge you to read on this subject is Pankaj Mishra's From the Ruins of Empire, and the second chapter is devoted to a scholar and intellectual called Liang Qichao. And Qichao was the foremost arguer for change in China throughout the latter part of the 19th century. And he believed that Confucianism needed to be adapted, updated, modified, and not abandoned, but really brought into an age where it could adapt to the challenges, the unprecedented challenges that were coming from the West. Now, obviously, within China's Mandarin classes, official bureaucrats who ran the empire, this is not really a welcome development. The new incumbent of the throne after 1861 was Prince Gong, who understood to some extent the importance of reform, and he knew firstly that he needed to make peace with the Western powers, and he proposed a self-strengthening movement in China, a series of reforms really that lasted over a 30-year period. His nemesis in court was the Dowager Empress Cixi, who a new biography is written about her recently by Zheng Chang, the writer of Wild Swans. Actually argues that she was a great moderniser. Most opinion tends not to view her in that light. It's a bit of a debate for another day. More of a kind of a saboteur of modernisation, with a great deal of influence in court and within the bureaucracy, a great deal of support for her anti-modernisation moves. There was a hope that by looking at the technical hardware of the West, it could be transposed to China and understood and adapted in a Confucian way. There was still a conceit that really there was nothing that the West could do or come up with that China couldn't do better using her own traditional methods. The interesting point about all of this is that that's precisely what Japan didn't do. Japan accepted that Western technology must be learned, and Western ways and Western constitutional styles of government as well, and institutional changes must be learned root and branch and applied. And, you know, there was no point in trying to alter what the West had done. The model must be completely taken on board and implanted into Japan. And the result is really that the Japanese were more successful in modernisation than the Chinese were. The Chinese official bureaucracy was not interested in social reform or anything other than adapting the technological advancements of the West. Some of this they do very successfully, but really it is the governmental and the institutional and bureaucratic stuff that and the changes to Chinese feudal society that by abandoning those doom the whole process, and as a result doom the Qing dynasty. By the 1890s, it's not only Westerners that China needs to be wary of, but a newly confident and assertive Japan, infused with new nationalist and pan-Asianist doctrines, looks upon China as being an ideal place to extend its hegemony over. Some Japanese nationalists at the time thought that China was the weak man of Asia and needed Japanese support, protection, guidance, and a kind of a paternalist approach from Japan in order to prevent it from being further colonised by Westerners. Other more aggressive voices looked upon China really as being the domain of the Japanese, and that the Chinese should be treated really in the same way that Westerners were treating Africans at the time. Both of these parties saw military intervention and colonization in China as being the prime requisite. Some had slightly more benign motivations than others. In 1894, the first Sino-Japanese war is lost by China with a result of the loss of Liaodong Peninsula, which is an area of huge strategic importance. The terminology that the Chinese use at the Treaty of Versailles when they attempt to get it back after World War One is that it was a dagger pointed at the heart of China. That's how essential they viewed it. And the next conflict that featured the Japanese would, of course, be the Russo-Japanese War 1904 to 1905, again, which would be fought in and around China at the Russian treaty port of Port Arthur, which would be attacked by the Japanese during that conflict, once again showing that the Japanese were the kind of regional hegemonic power in that period of time. So the period from the 1890s in China is viewed by a number of historians, particularly Robert Bickers in his excellent book, The Scramble for China, as a scramble for China. There is an equivalent process happening in Africa, the Scramble for Africa, where all of a sudden, in a very short space of time, huge swathes of African territory are swallowed up by European powers. And the Chinese were seen as being potentially the next victims of this process. The actual division and physical colonization of China was potentially being considered. From 1899 to 1901, the Western powers cooperated and organized between them effectively to destroy the last major anti-Western uprising of the period, the so-called Boxer Rebellion. The Boxers in question were members of a secret society based around a shamanistic martial arts culture. These were the inheritors of the Shaolin monks, and they had a series of mystical and unfortunately unrealizable beliefs about the abilities of the human body, and they had convinced themselves in many instances they were immune to gunfire, which transpired to not be the case. The uprising was slightly different this time from the Taiping Rebellion. It was in no way, shape or form on the same scale, and the focus of the protest was clearly articulated. It was a less an incoherent outpouring of rage and anger, and more an open attack on Western legations and Western parts of the Western colonized parts of China. The Dowager Empress Cixi throws her lot in with the Boxers, which is a spectacular misjudgment on her part, because the defeat of the Boxers really is the end of her power. The European troops, particularly French and Russian, were guilty of some horrific misconduct while they were marching their way towards Beijing. And Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany set the tone of his part of the expedition when he said to his troops, "Should you encounter the enemy, he will be defeated. No quarter will be given. Prisoners will not be taken. Whoever falls into your hands is forfeited. Just as 1,000 years ago the Huns under their king Attila made a name for themselves, one that even today makes them seem mighty in history and legend, may the name German be affirmed by you in such a way in China that no Chinese will ever dare to look cross-eyed at a German." So given this period of scramble for China, given this long assault on China and the imperial designs that were placed on China, it's small wonder that the country develops a robust revolutionary tradition, and the country has a large diaspora community overseas planning the overthrow of the Wei Qing dynasty. What to replace it with, whether to replace it with a constitutional monarchy, whether to replace it with a republic, is a matter that engages the diaspora in immense debate. And really, it's Sun Yat-sen who emerges as the main proponent of a new China. There'll be a podcast on him in the future, no doubt. There's perhaps a little run of time just right now to go delve deep into Sun Yat-sen. And you have to think in relatively small timescales here as well, in that within a decade from the Boxer Rebellion, there is a revolution in China that unseats the Qing dynasty. And within and a further 40 years, you see the establishment of Mao's communist state. So the relationship, really, between the emergence of modern China, and we are roughly a century away now, with China being the global economy of the 21st century. We're a century away now from the very last days of the Qing, well, the very early days of Sun Yat-sen's new China emerging. So this is why there is such a huge amount of emphasis and importance on the last half of the 19th century in China and the development of a kind of assertive sense of Chinese nationhood in the face of a number of external threats to not only China's economic, political and social well-being, but her philosophical Confucian sense of self and of Chinese-ness. So I'll leave it for there for today. I hope that's been useful. It's a very brief overview of a very complex period of historical transition and well worth investigating if you've got the time. If this is something that you're studying at the moment, you might want to download my Sun Yat-sen and the Birth of Modern China. You can find that at www.explaininghistory.com. And also the ebook Red Sun Rising about China, Japan and the West from the 1890s to 1941. Again, well worth a read. We're going to be doing some interesting things with Explaining History in the next few weeks. I'm going to be handing over the website in July to the very talented Ahmed Massoud. If you want to have a check out his writing, look at his new guest essay on the website about Britain, Africa and missionary activity in the 19th century. And we've got a new ebook title coming out, hopefully in the autumn. We'll be expecting Julia Routledge's The Genocidal Century. So look forward to that. We at Explaining History are on the lookout for some talented writers to help us out with some new work in the autumn, guest essays, ebooks, and maybe a couple of other projects that we're working on. So if you'd like to contribute, you can contact me at info@explaininghistory.com, and it'd be a great pleasure to hear from you soon. Thanks very much for listening, and enjoy.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.